The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
I'm Dennis Prager, sitting in for Hugh Hewitt. This week in the Town Hall Review, beneath the din of tax reform, the Trump administration releases a solid national security strategy.
Well, a document like this sets a strategic direction for the country to explain what the challenges are out there and to set forth a path on how we need to respond to those challenges.
And the GOP tax reform plan becomes a reality. We'll hear from one of the architects of the bill, Senator Pat Toomey.
On the individual side of our tax code, the key thing to know is the vast majority of Americans are getting a tax cut.
We'll hear from one of the architects of the bill, Senator Pat Toomey.
On the individual side of our tax code, the key thing to know is the vast majority of Americans are getting a tax cut.
And while you won't hear much about this from elite media, the president is nearing his first anniversary in the Oval Office, and the achievements are stacking up.
Talk about the unheralded decimation of ISIS in the Middle East. You look at massive deregulation.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Dennis Prager, sitting in for my friend and colleague, Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Over the course of the past few weeks, the deafening noise surrounding the GOP tax bill pretty much drowned out the news of a critical document released by the Trump administration. The document I'm referring to is the president's national security strategy. It was unveiled just before Christmas, signaling national security was among his administration's highest priorities. One expert called it, quote, the first serious top-down government-wide strategy produced since 1992 after the end of the Cold War, unquote. Shortly after the 60-plus page report was published, my colleague Hugh Hewitt spoke with one of its principal architects, Deputy National Security Director Nadia Shadlow.
Would you explain to people the purpose of going through an exercise to produce a 55-page, and pardon the apparent contradiction, comprehensive outline?
Sure. Well, a document like this sets a strategic direction for the country. It comes at the beginning of an administration, or is supposed to, and I'm proud that we did get it out early on, to set a direction for the country, to explain to the American people what the challenges are out there, what problem sets we're facing, and to set forth a path on how we need to respond to those challenges.
So when you have a deputies meeting from the various agencies, you're able to go to, say, page 30 and say, we made a commitment to modernize U.S. nuclear forces and infrastructure. The president signed off on it, and that means it takes a priority. Does that actually happen? Do you refer back to the document in the deputies meetings?
I'm already seeing that happening now, actually. We're using the document now to push forward in case there's uncertainty, or in case there's discussion, we're able to use the document to say, this is the way forward, this is what Capitol Hill needs to do to get on board, this is how we need to work with the Hill. So we're already using that, especially, for instance, in the aid area.
I want to go to cyberspace. This is in Pillar 3, about our military action. It lays out a problem. Malicious state and non-state actors use cyber attacks for extortion, information warfare, disinformation. And then it lays out the priority actions, improve attribution, accountability, and response. So when you have something like this, Dr. Shadlow, you're able to orient everyone in the government. This is what we're doing with cyber.
Right, exactly. It helps orient everyone. You can't spell out in exact detail what we're going to do, but it does provide the framework for moving forward in a different direction or continuing things that have worked as well.
Pillar number one, protect the American people, the homeland, the American way of life. Pillar two, promote American prosperity. Pillar three, preserve peace through strength. And pillar four, advance American influence. Let me ask you about one of the parts of pillar two, which is promote American prosperity. You write, or the National Security Strategy writes, embrace energy dominance. What's it mean?
It means essentially using all of the resources we have. It's a term that the president used to focus on best developing all of our natural energy resources in this country and using that dominance to ensure that countries aren't coerced by other countries in terms of energy, to ensure that the American people have access to a broad range of energy sources. So it is a significant shift from the past.
Let's close by talking about the regional aspects. And I want to go directly to our south, where the MS-13 continues to pump out an international, transnational cartel of criminals, and where Venezuela is in collapse. Have we been paying enough attention to the immediate threats posed to our south, Dr. Sadlow?
I think that's also another significant shift. Pillar One, which deals with problems directly within our borders, calls out the transnational criminal organizations, or TCOs as we call them, identifies the need to sever their sources of funding, to understand the kinds of drugs and other trafficking that's destroying our communities. We're looking at ways to change and improve our intelligence about these groups. The way we're looking at ways to fuse intelligence so at the local law enforcement level are linked to broader strategic level trends in the region. So we're really elevating this threat. DHS is on board as well. We worked very closely with the Department of Homeland Security. So there's a real effort to change the way that we collect information and use it so that it's real time and it moves up and down the chain from the State Department, who's seeing movements, down all the way to the local level.
In the eyes of many conservatives, perhaps the most notable accomplishment of this administration to date has been tax reform. Fittingly signed into law by President Trump just before Christmas and considered by its backers as a huge gift to the American public, it was met with hysteria by its opponents. Who are those opponents? I identified them on The Dennis Prager Show. It's a very big victory for the United States of America, the passage by the Republicans of this tax bill. Very big victory for America. It's already the economy is on such a wonderful trajectory, and this will just increase it. It is to the everlasting disgrace of the Democratic Party that every single one of them has voted against this, every single member of Congress, both in the House and in the Senate. This is a perfect example of the party in the thrall of leftism, not liberalism. John F. Kennedy was a liberal, and he said there's no way to stimulate the economy except for a tax cut. This nonsense about, well, it's for the rich. This is class warfare. I can't believe it. It should have died with Lenin. And it still invigorates the left. Class warfare. Oh, the rich benefit. The question isn't whether the rich benefit. The question is whether the society benefits. Let us say the rich benefit. So why is that automatically something that invalidates something from being good? Do you understand the world in which they live, the doctrinaire world? If it's good for the rich, it must be bad for others. They never question, it doesn't occur to them to say, well, maybe it's good for the rich and good for others, or even more amazingly, maybe it's good for the rich and therefore for others. But it isn't so much that it's good for the rich, it's good for corporations. But corporations hire people. Corporations pay wages. Also, the Democrats are in a terrible moral and historic position to criticize the economy or the economic policies of Republicans, given how successful in the first year of the Trump administration has been. Constant highs in the stock market and in every barometer. The wages of people are finally going up. The unemployment rate is going down. And yet none of this matters to the Democrats because they don't care about prosperity. Leftism cares about equality, not prosperity. You can't have both. That's the way it works, okay? Because equality is made by coercion. That means the free market cannot reign. The Democrats really do, in fact, want people to be angry and unhappy. If a black American is happy and grateful, the odds are that he won't vote Democrat. If a woman is happy and grateful, the odds are she won't vote Democrat. If a Latino is happy and grateful, the odds are he or she won't vote a Democrat. There's a word for a happy woman, and that word is Republican. Misery loves company should be the motto of the left. We're miserable, and we want others to be miserable. That's why they can't stand the Christmas season in so many instances, because it's a happy season. The media has been all over this GOP tax bill, with much of the coverage filled with misleading information. Hugh Hewitt was quick to examine the bill for himself, turning to Pennsylvania Senator Pat Toomey, who serves on the Senate Finance Committee.
before I go to what have you done for me lately, would you outline for the audience what you think is the key, you know, the key three or four things to know about this bill?
Yeah, sure. On the individual side of our tax code, the key thing to know is the vast majority of Americans are getting a tax cut. There will be some modest simplification and a net tax cut for the vast majority of the people that I represent, people all across America. That's number one. Number two, we're going to make our business tax code competitive so that American business and workers can compete and win. And we are going to encourage, I think, a tremendous wave of new investment, economic growth, demand for more workers, upward pressure on wages. I think we're going to we'll do that several ways. One is lowering the rate that we charge business income. One is allowing immediate expensing of the purchase of the kind of equipment that make workers more productive. Another is by fixing the badly flawed way that we treat the subsidiaries, foreign subsidiaries of multinationals.
What do you expect to do with that cash bump that comes in from, I think it's 8% on illiquid assets and 15.5% on liquid assets? And Apple, for example, has $250 billion stranded abroad.
Well, as you know, we're running a deficit now. And what we're going to do as a result of this bill is we're going to have smaller deficits. And our Democratic friends, their head explodes when I say that. But the fact is, a very modest bump in economic growth is going to generate more than enough new federal tax revenue by virtue of being able to tax a bigger economy than the revenue that we forego when you look at this on a purely static basis.
The Republicans get one more 51-vote bill. They pass a budget in 2018. That means you get one set of reconciliation instructions. I am hoping you use that to remove the sequester from the Department of Defense, but not the caps from domestic spending. What do you expect that 51-vote measure to be about, Senator Toomey?
Well, I think health care is so first of all, on your issue, look, I believe that we need to devote more resources to our defense budget, and we do not need a commensurate increase in non-defense domestic discretionary spending. I don't think we can use the reconciliation mechanism as the process for achieving that, because the whole appropriation process, that's always been a 60-vote process, and unless we're willing to revisit those rules, I don't think we can solve all that by using the budget.
You know, I really appreciate when I talk with you, Senator. When we talked last time about the college tuition becoming taxable income, you went back and you fixed that, and I appreciate your being willing to listen to stuff like this, because getting rid of that sequester on DOD, they cannot do long-term purchases. They can't build a 350-ship fleet operating on continuing resolutions and OCO add-ons. It just doesn't work that way.
No, there's no question. And I think there's increasing evidence that, look, we're endangering our own men and women by not providing them with the tools that they need, the training that they need. We've been underfunding too much of our defense for too long.
Coming up,
talk about the unheralded decimation of ISIS in the Middle East. You look at massive deregulation. You look at record-setting pace of circuit court judge confirmations.
A Trump administration scorecard when the town hall review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Dennis Prager, sitting in for Hugh Hewitt. As the year 2017 ends, there are few who want to give President Trump any credit for a successful first year. That is widespread among the liberal elite, but it's also present among some conservatives. My Salem colleague Mike Gallagher spoke with our mutual colleague Guy Benson, the political editor for townhall.com, who itemized Mr. Trump's accomplishments.
Let's talk a little bit about this Republican skirmish between the Never Trumpers and Trump supporters within the party. There was a scathing takedown of Jennifer Rubin the other day by Charles C.W. Cook at National Review, and then I think David French wrote a column back defending her. You know, there's still this bickering going on within the Republican community about Trump. Guy, regardless of what you think of him temperamentally or his tweets, it's really hard to argue that he hasn't had a very successful year when it comes to policy achievements. Is it possible to separate policy from temperament?
Well, that's what I've tried to do. Once he won the election, you know that I was never Trump during the election. Once he won, my outlook was this: he's president.
Right.
So let's evaluate everything that he does individually, and when it's good, don't pretend that it's not. You talk about the unheralded decimation of ISIS in the Middle East.
Yep.
You look at massive deregulation, especially vis-a-vis Obama's last-minute regulations that have been rolled back. You look at conservative judges, not just Justice Gorsuch, but a record-setting pace of circuit court judge confirmations in the first year.
Right.
You look at the tax reform bill that not only does a lot of important things on the tax front, but also opens up ANWR for drilling, something Republicans have sought forever. It repeals Obamacare's individual mandate tax. There's a lot to like.
There's a lot there.
Tax bill
there's a lot there.
From a conservative standpoint. And then there's like smaller things that sometimes people will lose sight of, such as, following through on a campaign promise regarding Jerusalem.
Right.
And the Paris Accords and making sure that we're putting the interests of the United States first.
Aren't these all things that conservatives should be celebrating, Guy?
Well, that's what I'm doing right now. And I think, Jen Rubin, she's unfortunately gone to such an extreme where she's a cartoon character of someone who is so viscerally opposed to Trump that she's actually reversing her own positions.
Right.
Her own long.
So that she's
positions.
Not aligned with him.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a very weird thing to watch.
It's a strange place
Charles
to be.
Cook's, Charles Cook's takedown was pretty brutal on her, and David Frum wrote the defense that I didn't really.
David Frum, not David French. I'm sorry. Yeah, you're right, David Frum.
Yeah, but in any case, look, I would say despite all of the intramural fighting, you look at what happened in the Senate with the exception of John McCain, who would have voted yes. He's in favor of the bill, but he's obviously fighting cancer back home in Arizona.
We pray for him.
You had everyone from the most Make America Great Again pro-Trump senators in that chamber, all the way down to Jeff Flake and Bob Corker and everyone in between, Ben Sasse, Marco Rubio. They all got together as a team and said, this is the right
thing. This is the right thing for this country. Yep.
This achieves our goals. Let's get it done. And by the way, it should be said over and over again, every single Senate Democrat voted against a bill that massively cuts taxes for the middle class, makes American business much more competitive, and according to all of the nonpartisan experts, will grow the U.S. economy. And Democrats have been lying relentlessly about it.
You may have caught the line from Guy Benson in that last segment where he spoke of the, quote, unheralded decimation of ISIS, unquote, and how ignoring this development was a major fault of our American media. The ISIS caliphate that was established in Iraq shortly after President Obama pulled our troops spread massive death and destruction in Iraq and throughout the region, and ISIS-inspired terrorism has hit countless sites worldwide, including the recent attack in New York City. ISIS no longer has a center, and much of its leadership is dead. Columnist Ross Douth out of the New York Times recently wrote of the media's shameful lack of coverage, calling this a war that Trump won. I looked at the Douthat column on my program. Ross Douthat, who's one of the Never Trumpers, and he writes at the New York Times, he's one of the three non-leftists of the dozen or so columnists that they have. There's no real conservative as such. And I would say that as a criticism, just as a description. But there are three non-leftists, Ross Douthat and Brett Stephens and David Brooks. Ross, he writes actually in praise of Donald Trump to his great credit. He's speaking about the defeat of ISIS. Its defeat was begun under Obama, and the hardest fighting has been done by Iraqis. But this was an American war, too, and we succeeded without massive infusions of ground troops, without accidentally getting into a war with Russia, and without inspiring a huge wave of terrorism in the West. Why haven't we noticed the success? He gives a number of reasons, and he adds this one. This is also a press failure, a case where the media is not adequately reporting an important success because it does not fit into the narrative of Trumpian disaster in which our journalistic entities are all invested. To see these words in the New York Times is sort of a miracle. You know, when the Jews say the blessing over the lighting of the Hanukkah candles, the second of the two blessings is blessing God who made miracles in those days and in ours as well. This may be one of them. That someone writing in the New York Times acknowledges that the media are invested, that's his fine word, in the narrative of Trumpian disaster. I include myself in this indictment. How do you like that? That's very impressive on Ross Douthat's part. Foreign policy is the place where the risks of electing Trump seem to me particularly unacceptable. And I've tended to focus on narratives that fit that fear. This Trump administration's approach to the Middle East has been moderately successful and indeed close to what I would have hoped for from a normal Republican president following a realistic internationalist course. And then he adds this, the relatively mild reaction to recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital may be a case study in expert consensus falling behind the facts. Get that, folks? Remember the expert consensus? How much violence the recognition by the United States of Jerusalem as Israel's capital will engender? He writes, the Arab world has different concerns than it did in 1995, and Trump's move has helped clarify that change. He ends his piece. If you had told me in late 2016 that almost a year into the Trump era, the caliphate would be all but beaten without something far worse happening in the Middle East, I would have been surprised and gratified. So, very provisionally, credit belongs where it's due. To our soldiers and diplomats, yes, but to our president as well. Coming up,
there does appear to be extraordinarily strong evidence of collusion between one of the presidential campaigns and the Russians.
Michael Medved, when the Town Hall Review continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Dennis Prager, in for Hugh Hewitt. Russia conspiracy, collusion, and treason is a topic that we'll not miss hearing about when and if the various investigations are over. Thus far, we've had Trump campaign staffers indicted, General Michael Flynn's plea of guilty, a presidential candidate under investigation, and now another name has surfaced. Green Party presidential candidate Dr. Jill Stein, who won less than 1% of the vote in 2016, is also under investigation before the Senate Intelligence Committee. Here's my Salem colleague, Michael Medved.
Let me tell you what I heard, and I heard this yesterday, and then I've been able to dig out some more information about it. But there does appear to be extraordinarily strong evidence of collusion between one of the presidential campaigns and the Russians. And no, I'm not talking about the Trump campaign. Yes. There's evidence against Paul Manafort. He looks about as guilty as sin. There's evidence against his associate, Richard Gates. George Papadopoulos has already pleaded guilty. Michael Flynn has already pleaded guilty. But this involves the candidate herself. And no, I'm not talking about Hillary Clinton. I'm talking about Jill Stein. Now, of all the people running for president, we had not just two of the worst candidates ever, in my opinion. We had four of the worst candidates ever, because usually if you have two candidates who are very controversial and very weak, and that was certainly true for Secretary Clinton, it was certainly true for Mr. Trump. If you have two candidates who are very weak, then at least some of the third and fourth party candidates are appealing. But do you remember what a bozo Gary Johnson was, the former governor of New Mexico? I appreciate the fact that he came on the show a couple of times. But for goodness sake, if this isn't living proof that extended marijuana use does very bad things to your cognitive abilities, I don't know what is. Do you remember what's in Aleppo? I mean, this guy was not ready for prime time. Now, Jill Stein was even worse. Jill Stein is a hardcore Marxist leftist creep. She is profoundly anti-American. She's profoundly anti-Israel, even though she was the only Jewish candidate in the race. And It turns out that the Senate Intelligence Committee has found that there were extensive reasons to believe that Jill Stein was collaborating with Putin and with Russia. Like what? Okay, you remember how Michael Flynn got in a world of trouble because he went to a banquet in Russia where he sat at the same table with Vladimir Putin? This was to celebrate RT, that's Russia Today. It's a television network that they just started RT France to try to attack Macron. Look, Putin is nuts. I mean, maybe I know, nuts like a fox. But he basically has used a great deal of state money, which is basically all stolen because it's one of the most corrupt regimes in the world. And Putin has gone ahead and operated and set up these television networks, RT, to tell his story, which he believes is Russia's story. So there was a celebration of RT, Russia Today. She traveled to Moscow for this dinner celebrating the 10th anniversary of RT, the state-run news organization that American intelligence agencies have concluded was being used to spread propaganda during the presidential campaign, and by the way, before then too. Photographs from the event show Dr. Stein sitting at a table with President Putin of Russia and other prominent government officials. Now, why is this? Why would they be interested in Jill Stein? I mean, Jill Stein got below 1% of the vote. She didn't do all that well. She was running as the Green Party candidate for president. She was running on a basically eliminate the American military, substitute the white flag of surrender for the red, white, and blue. The only area where she wanted more American involvement in the world was on behalf of the Palestinians. And Jill Stein is in Russia, at least according to some of the sources at the Senate Intelligence Committee, because they figured that she could take votes away from Hillary Clinton, who the Russians hated more than any other candidate. And they did. And how did that work? Well, here's the basic thing. If you look at the three decisive states that Trump carried that gave him the majority of the Electoral College, despite the fact that he lost popular vote, it was Wisconsin, it was Michigan. In both of those states, Jill Stein got more votes than the margin of difference between Hillary and Trump. In other words, if you assume that all the people who voted for Jill Stein would have otherwise voted for Hillary, she would have won those states, both Wisconsin and Michigan. And it would have been very, very close in Pennsylvania. The point being, this doesn't implicate the Trump campaign at all. But it does implicate Jill Stein as a pathetic tool of a wretched and evil dictatorship. Jill Stein is disgusting. And boy, Mueller and Senate Intelligence Committee, go get her.
Coming up.
The reason the story is noble, in my little opinion, is that Churchill makes a point in his account of the war that this is a noble story because the people save their own freedom.
Dr. Larry Arnn on The Darkest Hour when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Dennis Prager, in for the vacationing Hugh Hewitt. A new movie has just been released, which has the attention of both World War II buffs and admirers of Sir Winston Churchill. Darkest Hour is about Churchill's agonizing decisions in leading Great Britain through the long, bleak, and ultimately victorious fight against Nazi Germany. The creator of the film relied on the Churchill archives housed at Hillsdale College in Michigan. Larry Arnn, Hillsdale's president and former director of research for Martin Gilbert, Churchill's official biographer, was the guest of Hugh Hewitt.
You know, I'm going to have the writer of the movie on next week. I'm going to tape an interview with Andrew McCartan because he did a fine job writing. The scene on the subway, which is constructed, is nevertheless authentic. And unlike the scene injected into Nixon Frost, where Nixon is drunkenly talking to David Frost late at night, wholly invented. Ron Howard, I asked him about it on air. He said, I needed it to move the script along. But it was not true. The scene on the subway is not true either, but it's not inauthentic.
The reason the story is noble, in my little opinion, and the reason contriving scenes on a subway passes muster with me, Martin Gilbert might be spitting in his grave, is that Churchill makes a point in his account of the war that this is a noble story because the people saved their own freedom. They were brave. And he uses the expression, he uses many expressions like this, they were the lion. I was only called upon to give the roar. And so on the subway, these five citizens that Churchill talks to, they suggest phrases that Churchill made famous. Never, they say once, you know, make a peace with Hitler, right? And at the end of the subway scene, Churchill is inspired by these people talking to him. He's counseling with them about how to, whether they should make a peace or not, which is really what the movie is about. And there's a West Indian subject of the Queen. And at the end, Churchill is muttering or speaking softly to himself one of his favorite things, which is Horatius at the Gate from Macaulay's Lays of Ancient Rome, which Churchill memorized famously when he was a kid in school. And he's muttering, he's, you know, an outstanding brave Horatius, the captain of the gate, to every man born on this earth, death cometh soon or late. And how can men die better than facing fearful odds for the ashes of their fathers and the temples of their gods? And this West Indian is in the background, and he is saying the words too. So it's a chorus, you see, of the British people, whose record in the Second World War is very remarkable.
It is.
So the movie's about that, and that is the story that Churchill has to tell through and later about the war. That's why it's authentic.
Let me go back to the Oldman interview you conducted and play Gary Oldman talking with you about the rigors of the filming schedule. Cut number five.
Yes, Lucy Sibbick and David Malinowski, who were the people on a day-to-day basis, were applying and painting me and looking after me. And their hours were ridiculous because they have to come in. If I'm getting in a car at 1:45 a.m., Dave had to be there an hour before to set up.
Right, so we watched you all day long that day, and you were cheerful and courteous to everybody you saw, and who saw you, including us, all day long. Yeah. So you could see why actors would be mean. It's harder to see why you're not.
I'm telling you, God, I had to work a long day, you know, and that sound you can hear is the smallest violin playing. you know, I figured if Winston Churchill could take on Adolf Hitler at 65... I can sit in a makeup chair for 3.5 hours.
You made that point, Larry Arndt. You know that one of my favorite lines in the Essays of Montaigne is, constant cheerfulness is the surest sign of wisdom. And so that is something about which to know about people, that they are constantly cheerful.
There's a thing parallel to that by Dr. Johnson about how if you see a man of good character, he pays attention to one. And I struggle with that. I'm busy and I'm a multitasker and all that, but it reminds me, being around him, around Gary Oldman, whom I admire, it reminds me that, you know, you're supposed to work really hard and you're supposed to keep your attention on the things, on the places where it should be. That includes the other people around you.
Always.
One more.
You have to practice it to get into the habit of it. One more Gary Oldman cut on self-doubt while playing Churchill.
You know, it wasn't all, I would have 3 days of working on this role, and then I would go wobbly, and I'd say to Doug or Giselle, oh, God, what have I let myself in for? You know, I can't. Do it. I won't be, you know, this is awful. I won't be any good. So you go through this, and really it was Douglas and Giselle separately, but who said to me, what's the worst thing that could happen? The worst thing that could happen is you could be really awful. And, you know, and they're not going to get a van and carry me away or shoot me. They will with the critics will with their pen, but you had a go at it and you failed. But in the process, you got to stand in a room with 600 people and say, I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. I get to stand in a room and say, we shall fight in France, we shall fight on the seas and oceans.
Doctor, what a great performance by him, and he obviously brought the right attitude and had the right people around him to deliver.
Oh, yeah. We advise students, I was talking to a kid last night, about what he picks to write his doctoral thesis about. And I said, it's like getting married. You know, you're going to know it for the rest of your life. I wrote mine on Winston Churchill. Here am I, right? An old man now, still talking about it. And one of the points that he's making there is he's played some really great roles, and they're very worthy roles. And then you play the role, and then you go around for months, and you're sort of in the role while you promote the movie. You live with that person. Well, who are you going to pick? Winston Churchill. He's saying it's a different kind of life when you're doing that than when you're playing some other person.
Yeah.
So that's why he decided to do it, finally. He just said, I'm going to live like that for a while.
And I think we can say with confidence that people who go to see The Darkest Hour are going to be very, very happy that they did.
Coming up,
all the smart money is on the fact that it's going to come down 5-4. And as often is the case, Justice Kennedy appears to be the swing vote.
The free exercise clause on trial when we return for the final segment of the Town Hall Review. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Dennis Prager in for Hugh Hewitt. On December 5th, the Supreme Court heard arguments on one of the key religious liberty cases in our generation. You've likely heard of it. It's Masterpiece Cake Shop versus Colorado Civil Rights Commission. Although the outcome will likely be close, observers think Jack Phillips, the owner of Masterpiece Cake Shop, was well represented before the court. Here's Hugh Hewitt's interview of Michael Farris, CEO of Alliance Defending Freedom, just prior to the arguments before the court.
Would you agree with my assessment that Masterpiece Cake Shop is the most important free exercise case in three decades?
Yes, I fully agree. Ed Meese said that he thought it was the most important free exercise case in American history.
Would you explain what Masterpiece Cake Shop is about and what ADF's role in it is?
Jack Phillips is a cake artist. He designs beautiful wedding cakes in Denver, Colorado. When two men came into his cake business to ask him to do a custom cake for their wedding celebration, he politely declined, telling them that he doesn't do cake designs that violate his conscience. The Colorado Civil Rights Commission held that this was a violation of their state law, and
now
ADF is lead counsel in the case.
How confident you feel about this?
Well, I'm very confident that it's going to be really close. All the smart money is on the fact that it's going to come down 5-4. And as often is the case, Justice Kennedy appears to be the swing vote. He's one of the strongest advocates for same-sex marriage, but he's also got a very strong history on free speech. So it's kind of two of his legacy issues are at conflict in this case, whether he's going to stand with free speech, which would be devastated if he goes the wrong way, whereas same-sex marriage, you know, what happened to the two guys, they had to go a few blocks away to another bakery, and in fact, they got their cake for free when the news was out. So the implications for free exercise or religion and freedom of speech are amazingly devastating. If the government can coerce us to say what it wants us to say, really, we can't call ourselves a free country anymore.
Alliance Defending Freedom will be sharing time before the court with the Solicitor General. And that telegraphs that the United States Department of Justice believes very much that this is a central case. So that itself is a big win, isn't it, Mike Farris, that the federal government has come in on the side of Jack Phillips?
It is. And, you know, of course, the fact that the court took the case was the first big win, and then the Solicitor General's participation is the second, and we're very hopeful that we're going to have the ultimate win of the court saying our country still believes in freedom of speech and free exercise of religion. You can't force people to violate their conscience.
Well, thanks for joining us for the Town Hall Review. Catch up on past episodes at our website, townhallreview.com. Subscribe to our podcast while you're there and never miss an episode. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richards, David Posian, and Shonda Chisola. Join us next week for another edition of Town Hall Review, the Week in Review program from a perspective you can trust. From all of my colleagues here at the Salem Media Group, let me wish you a very happy new year with many blessings for the year ahead. I'm Dennis Prager for Hugh Hewitt.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.